has to order, must be about 5 minutes or 6 minutes after the hour on the 22nd. Present, we have Representatives Stevens, Cisna, Wilson, Coghill, and myself, Chair Dyson. I understand Representative Jewell and Coring will be here shortly. And our first order of business is to finish up the work we began on Tuesday on House Bill 115, then we'll take up House Bill 124 and finish the work we had on it. Then we have two new pieces, I think, House Bill 142 and 98, and we'll try to get done with Senate Bill 19. So I don't think we'll be departing from that order, so if any of you want to go on about your other work and be useful instead of sitting in on all these exciting proceedings, well, feel free, and if you need one of us to call you when you're up, we'll be glad to do that. All right. Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Kapsner. I represent District 39. I'm here before you with the, draft version F of House Bill 115. Is that correct, Randy?
Yes.
Okay.
It has to be adopted.
All right. Will someone move that we adopt the F version?
That's me.
Representative Wilson moves that we adopt the F version as our working document. Is there objection? Hearing none, we have before us the F version. All right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I have before you three amendments. The first one is the most minor. I think I'll address that first. It's the one I offered myself. And all it does is delete, on page 2, line 3, delete master and insert clinical.
All right, well, let's see, page 2, line 3. All right, would someone like to move that on the committee? Representative Coghill?
Before I move, may I ask a question on that?
You may.
Mary, is that a designation that is significant? Master social worker certainly is a degree, but clinical means, can you give me the comparison?
It is the same. It's the same. It's just, I think, cleaning up the language. Sharon, do you want to, Representative Cisna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is it's a different level. It's got different training in it. Am I correct? It's licensure, yeah. And it means a different coursework, if I'm not mistaken. It's got, actually, you know, there are people who could testify on this.
Yeah.
This was brought to me by the request of Ann Henry, so I'd like for her to
say right. That. Ms. Henry?
Oops. Sorry. Through the chair, the designation of licensed clinical social worker means that the person has a master's degree plus 2 years of experience in order to get that clinical license.
Can I move the amendment?
All right. Representative Coghill moves Amendment 1. Is there objection? Hearing none, Amendment 1 is adopted. And if I may, Representative Kapsner, the second amendment is mine, and it says 22.LS0059/F.2 in the upper right hand corner forward. And what this one will do is the gist of it is that a person can be considered for a involuntary commitment if they are a danger to their own unborn child. I'm thinking particularly here about FAS, prenatal alcohol poisoning, particularly, or so on.
That just doesn't fit then. Their own unborn child?
Yes.
Okay, let me cross that line off.
Yeah. Representative Wilson correctly points out that both on and should be crossed out on all of them. So it would read, it inserts the phrase, or their own unborn child. And on page 1, line 5, in the title, it inserts following intoxication related to commitment based on intoxication or alcohol or drug abuse. Does that, I don't understand why the drafter puts it there, but they thought it was important. Do you understand, Representative Kapsner?
Do I understand what, why they put that there?
Yeah, inserted on line 2, page 1, relating to commitment based on intoxication or alcohol or drug abuse.
I don't know.
I don't either. I don't see that it would hurt anything. Apparently the drafter. Randy?
Yes.
Can you tell us why Ford thought the on the F2 amendment relating to this expression relating to commitment based on intoxication stuff, why he thought that sentence was important?
He did not express why that sentence was important. His main issue was to make sure that thought was covered in all in both sections of the statutes. Yeah. I'm not sure about the top. I can call and ask.
Would you?
Sure.
Did you, for the record, Representative Coring and Jewell have joined us. Representative Coring about 10 after the hour, and Representative Jewell about 12 after. Representative Wilson?
Yeah, you're that on also.
Yeah, I think I said that. On the amendment, and all of the added phrases on lines 8 and 9, 17 and 20, of the new language, you cross out both on and, so it reads, or their own unborn child. We'll take a brief at ease. Where, Mary, if you don't object, there's a, you have an unknown ally here who I've known for quite a while, who would like to speak to the necessity of your bill. Diane, would you care to join us?
Let me just scoot over.
Representative Kapsner, this is Diane Weber.
Hi, Diane. How do you do today?
Who is single-handedly responsible for all the child advocacy centers in the state.
Not exactly.
Well, she is our patron saint in that movement, has got all these things going, and is now working in Galena on mental health. Ms. Weber, would you please give us your testimony of why Representative Kapsner's bill is valuable?
Representative Dyson, thank you for allowing me to speak. It's an excellent bill, but I would like to, the recorder would like you to state your name. Diana Weber, Director, Yukon Koyukuk Mental Health, Galena. It's an excellent bill, but I'd like to make a point, please, in regards to delivering mental health services in rural Alaska. We have some of the highest levels of alcohol abuse and fetal alcohol syndrome in our area as any place in the state. And mental health centers, community mental health centers in rural Alaska, have a very difficult time getting licensed master's clinical providers. I would like to make a suggestion that possibly we consider broadening the list of people who can qualify to provide commitment to the same master's level providers that Medicaid approves to do bill for clinical work, which would include some unlicensed master's level providers, such as masters in counseling psychology. The reason is, it is very hard for master's level providers in rural Alaska to get licensed because they don't have access, face-to-face access, to the same psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers who could supervise them.
Okay, Diane, after the hearing or something, you can talk with Representative Kapsner, and perhaps if you can convince her that that would be a valuable thing to do when this gets over to the Senate side, you know, and so on, if she agrees, it could be amended to do that. In the process of what we're doing here today, it's too late for us to do that, in my opinion, unless, of course, that's Representative Kapsner's decision. But I would appreciate if you would speak to why what Representative Kapsner is doing here is valuable and how difficult it is to do involuntary commitments.
Thank you. I will do that.
but it's an excellent bill otherwise.
No, no, I meant now, you could just say.
Oh, yeah. You want me to do that again?
Just say why this bill is valuable.
Well, the bill is valuable because currently, the way it exists in my area, involuntary commitments can only be authorized by a physician or a psychiatrist, and unfortunately, or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, we don't have any. So in order to get somebody committed, we have to get them to Fairbanks, convince them to go to Fairbanks to get committed. Well, if we, we wouldn't need to commit them if we did that. So the way the law stands now does not serve areas that are underserved by medical professionals anyway. So I wholeheartedly endorse adding master's level clinicians in some form or other to be able to make those clinical decisions regarding commitment. It would be very helpful to us.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You got Ford online, Randy?
I'm here.
All right. Mr. Ford, thank you. We're looking at your amendment here on Committee Substitute for House Bill 115. I'm looking at the backslash F2. Can you explain to us what your reasoning was for inserting the wording on line 2?
The problem we had was that title as written did not include, it's not broad enough.
The title isn't broad enough.
A reference to allow the inclusion of the language on line 6 as well.
You understand what he said?
Title isn't broad enough.
Yeah,
title wouldn't be broad enough as written.
To include the stuff that's in section 2.
Correct.
All right. All right. So it's your decision, Representative Kapfner, if you want to broaden the title a little bit to include the section 2 here for commitments for the protection of the unborn child. It's your call.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a very worthy idea. I'm just starting to feel like my bill is becoming a Christmas tree, and my title is getting bigger and bigger. And really, when I introduced this bill, I wanted to allow mid-level practitioners to sign the commitment papers for involuntary commitment, and then we broadened it to mental health professionals, and now it's becoming an FAS issue. So I'd kind of like to keep my original intent and perhaps look at doing this at another time in a separate bill, if that's all right with you.
It's your bill. And your call.
Another thing I'm concerned about is this bill dying because of this amendment. And it's not that I don't think it's a very worthy cause. I understand very personally the effects of FAS and FAE and how detrimental it is and how we need to be able to involuntarily commit people who are threatening to create FAE and FAS children. But I would rather leave my bill the way it is.
Okay. And this amendment has not been proposed. So we have before us CS for House Bill 115 / F with Amendment 1 changing master to clinician on page 2, line 3. Is there any further discussion or questions from the committee? Chair will entertain a motion.
So move, Mr. Chairman, that we move House Bill 115 as amended.
I have one minor amendment as well.
You're too late.
Okay. Okay. The minor amendment that I have is on page 3, line 4. On Tuesday, we added medical examiner, and I think the word should be medical provider.
Say again where you're at.
Page 3, line 4. Medical examiner. To my understanding, deals with examining people after they've died. So I think we should change that to medical provider.
All right. My F version has page 3, line 4. Certificate must be set out by the physician crossed out, medical examiner's. Findings and material crossed out in support of the allegation of the petition.
It was changed last week on Tuesday to medical examiner with a verbal amendment, and it should be medical provider.
All right, so you want the word examiner to change to provider?
Yes.
Would you, somebody move that?
I still move.
Representative Wilson moves to change medical examiner to medical provider on line 4, page 3.
In plural, providers.
Medical providers. All right. Anything else, Representative Kaplan, on your Christmas tree?
No.
All right. The chair will entertain a motion on this bill.
Move, Mr. Chairman. Once again, House Bill 115, as amended, the F version, with attached fiscal note.
Zero fiscal.
And with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? House Bill 115 is moved. Now take up House Bill, I believe, 124. Who's here to make a presentation on 124? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Hand. I'm staff representative Andrew Halpro, who represents the 12 in Anchorage. And I would just like to succinctly describe to you the changes in the work draft that you have before you for House Bill 124. It is work draft O as in Oscar. And briefly, the changes that have taken place are the addition of mirror language for criminal background checks for nursing homes that mirrors the language that was already present for assisted living facilities, and that basically encompasses in Section 1 at the beginning of the bill. The second major change is the alteration of the barrier crimes themselves that are being set out in statute.
Excuse me. I don't have the old version.
It's, Mr. Chairman, it's on our, it was on our piles.
It's just in
there. Oh, okay. Never mind. I think I found it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good if everybody has it. Thank you.
Where's Andrew?
Labor and Commerce. They had a, they were in need of him in Labor and Commerce, which was 315 today because of Northern Edge having held up that meeting yesterday.
All right. Start over again, would you please, sir?
Yes. Just review again, Oscar work draft O, so everybody has it in front of them. The first change.
As I remember, when we left on Thursday last, a week ago, we asked that it was several pieces that need to be come together to fix this. So you're going to tell us what's happened to fix the issues that came up last Thursday, right?
Correct.
All right. Maybe you can tell us what the problems were that you left here with, the bill left here with, and direct us to the solution.
Okay. I will do so, Mr. Chairman. The first one, the amendment that was written out and actually handed to the committee was the inclusion of language for criminal background checks that involved nursing homes in addition to assisted living facilities. That was proposed by the administration. What we have done is basically taken that as it was written and rolled it into this bill so it fit and was congruent. And that is now what comprises the new Section 1 at the beginning of the bill, criminal background checks relating to a nursing facility. And you will notice that, the language in Section 1 all the way through Section 3 on page 4, what begins at Section 4 is the same language, basically a duplicate relating to assisted living homes. And so Sections 1, 2, and 3, that's what I mean, is Sections 1, 2, and 3 will mirror Sections 4, 5, and 6, I believe, or maybe just 4 and 5, one pertaining to nursing homes, one pertaining to assisted living facilities. And by what I mean by that is the section pertaining to specifically to nursing facilities was absent from the previous draft. And we're definitely in agreement with that, no problem at all in including that language for criminal background checks for nursing homes as well. The second major point of contention last time, Mr. Chairman, was that Class A misdemeanors were far too broad in the thought that there were some Class A misdemeanors that had no relevance to a person's ability to serve in this capacity as a aide in nursing homes. So what we have done is removed the inclusion of all Class A misdemeanors.
Where are you at now?
Okay. And what we have is section, the first one, there's two, again, since it's two portions of language, the first one is in, which is section one on page three, line seven, in section five there, subsection five. It previously had said, just for points of comparison, it had said within the previous 5 years of a Class C felony or a Class A misdemeanor, including all Class A misdemeanors, or an offense under another jurisdiction of another state. What we have done here is included Class C felonies, removed all the blanket of Class A misdemeanors, and included two specific Class A misdemeanors, of which are the improper use of a corpse, and the second one is, which is currently in regulation, just to make sure I give you the correct ones, is and that's what is referenced there in AS 1156-84 and 1161-130. So it includes just those two misdemeanors and then leaves it to the point of regulations to add any that they see fit beyond that. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, so what's the one of them is the
one of them is
the corpse and
improper use of the corpse, and the second one is vulnerable adults, second degree, correct? Failure to register as a sex offender is that second Class A misdemeanor. Yes.
All right.
And and just for clarification, the second place that will show up is in section four on page five, line 28. You will see again that it's mirror language pertaining to nursing facilities. We have again removed the blanket Class A misdemeanor and inserted those two specific crimes, offenses, and retained the language that relates them to other state law.
All right.
And to explain the committee, to explain the third change that has been made in
wait
this.
A minute, wait a minute.
Yes, sir.
I assume. Never mind. Okay, go ahead.
Is there any?
No.
Okay, great. The third point that was that is new in this draft involves the emergency involuntary termination of a contract, which begins on, the new language begins roughly on page 8, but the sections are, let's see here. There is new language, but the meat of the change involves in section 10, which is actually on page 9. You'll see there under AS 4733-370, which creates a new section.
What that line number?
Line 20 on page 9. This is a new section that the departments had requested to allow emergency involuntary termination of a contract on behalf of a resident. What we have done is changed the language to, and the bulk of the change of this section from the previous draft comes on page 11 in lines 1 through 10, section 10 there. Previously, it was a minimum of a 24-hour requirement, maximum of a 72, and a case conference on behalf of the resident could be requested. What we have done is lengthen that to a 72-hour minimum time before revocation of that contract, stated that if a resident or the resident's representative, if any, representative advocate, and if any, home administrator, or the appropriate care provider, what we have done is put in language specifically pertaining to the long-term care ombudsman and stated that they must receive notice of the termination of contract as well. Of course, just for clarification, the long-term care ombudsman is not part of this process until they are requested on behalf of the resident, but the they thought it would be good to receive notice at least that there was this emergency revocation happening, in fact, so that they would at least be apprised of the situation.
Representative Wilson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, did you say it was on page 11?
On page 11, correct.
I don't see anything in bold that would tell me there's new language.
It is all a new section.
Okay.
All of it is it's a new section added. So
section 11?
And it actually begins is on page 9, line 19, section 10 of the bill. is all new language. Hence the reason that it's not bold in the letter. And again, just to outline it, it is mandating notice to the long-term care ombudsman. And also, if within that 72 hours, from the 72 hours in which the resident received notice of this termination, they have up to that point, if they give notice of request of a conference within that 72 hours, they must be given one within 72 hours from that request point. And what, in fact, we have done is changed the language to strengthen it a little bit, in which comes in lines 9 and 10 on page 11, stating that an appropriate care provider shall discuss the justification for and the appropriateness of the contract termination. And the language previous, as you might see in your draft, was a little weak, so we thought maybe that was a little more direct to the point that, in fact, they had to provide justification as to why they were doing an emergency revocation of a residence contract. Those are the meat of the changes between the work drafts. There is one point of contention that remains in this bill that we are continuing to work on. I think we have a very good dialogue to begin. We are both working together, the administration and ourselves, to come up with a constructive solution to the matter, and that is the inclusion of any offense in which the victim was a resident of a nursing home or receiving long-term care facilities. As you might remember from last time the testimony received, there was difficulty in implementing that because of difficulty in finding information of past cases and the burden upon the administration to investigate those cases and see, in fact, to look at those court cases, who was, in fact, the victim of the crime and where they might have lived at the time was difficulty. And we think we might have some creative solutions to that problem, but at that point it still remains in this draft.
So you're asking us to pass this out without you fixing that?
In the mind of the sponsor, Mr. Chairman, that is an integral part of the bill. And just to give you an example, that one that has been passed around by the long-term care ombudsman, as an example, is there is a nursing home employee who just recently was charged with petty theft. In effect, they just stole a credit card from a resident of a nursing home. This happened up in South Central Alaska. They took the credit card, used it for personal use, and then, in fact, were caught and charged with that offense. There is nothing banning that person from going back and working in a nursing facility starting tomorrow morning. We thought if we were going to go through the trouble of going outlining barrier crimes in statute and doing and taking your time to outline these crimes so that crimes that get victims of residents of nursing homes as victims of crimes were completely stopped in this state, that we had to keep that in there, that portion that related to them as residents, as victims, because this, without that portion, would not have any relevance to the crime I just mentioned. So we thought that it would be sort of a moot point if here we'd have a situation where a resident of a nursing home was a victim of such a crime, and yet this bill wouldn't address it. So that to be an integral part that we are not ready to let loose of yet.
All right. There was one other issue that came up, and that is it's current practice for the folks to get their crime record ran in a state, you know, checked against the state's crime thing, which you can get immediately, and then go to work. And the issue was, what if the person just got off the boat and could have an extensive criminal record somewhere else? Nothing here. And under this bill as it stands, the nursing home would put them to work.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, and that remains, although a difficult one, it was the consensus of all those, including on the sides who are advocates on behalf of residents, the ombudsman, or the group called Caring that brought this to our attention originally, that, albeit a negative circumstance, was an acceptable one, although chagrined, because of the labor pool problems that we currently have in the state, that those people, by the time there was testimony given, that by the time the FBI background check would come back and the state would go through all of its obligations to do the background checks for licensing, that person would have by that point found some other employment. And with the tight employment, especially in areas of rural Alaska, that would be very detrimental to the employees that these nursing facilities are trying to hire. So that as of yet, remains unresolved in this bill.
My suggestion was that you not that you add language so that somebody who's just new to the state, hasn't been here for some period of your choosing, 6 months or a year, not be put either to work pending it, or they'd be done never to work alone. And apparently you didn't like that suggestion.
There was one point brought up, Mr. Chairman, that it was that, from my understanding, it was irrelevant whether they were new to the state or not, this time it would take to get that background check done. If those, because would take the same amount of time, assuming that they did not have any offenses in the state, because they can do that fast, quick check. It checks the state systems. Assuming nothing turned up on that, it was irrelevant between people new to the state or had been here for a while, assuming they had an offense outside of the state.
Yeah. I probably failed to communicate, or you guys weren't listening. What I said was, if they were just off the boat, they either their work is supervised so they're not alone, or don't put them to work. And to me, it seems to me that is a significant improvement. I'm not charmed by your idea that with all this work to provide security for seniors and vulnerable adults, you're willing to give that up because of the labor shortage, and you're willing to take somebody that just got off the airplane, you know, and so on. But that's your position.
Mr. Chairman, that's a very valid point. And if there is a way to find that addressable and not have a significant impact, according to those out there in the fields, that we definitely would be very open to addressing it.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, with the points that you raised, you know, about somebody just coming to our state and refusing them work, if we could do that. It seems that we've tried in different ways, albeit in different circumstances, to have local hire laws done. They've all been struck down by the courts. And so I'm just wondering legally whether or not we could do that at all based on those kinds of court cases. Because it same similar issues, but as it relates, so I'm just wondering, I don't know who can answer that.
My sense is that you can refuse to hire somebody pending a background check, or you can put the special qualifications on. They're going to work supervised until the background check is completed. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question and then a follow-up.
Sure.
How long does it take to do the background check usually?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. As my understanding, general terms, it probably takes upwards of 90 days. And the delay being on the FBI side of things, it takes their turnaround. Then that's my understanding. There might be someone from the administration who could give us a more specific figure.
But it's instantaneous, virtually, for their local police records. That's why there's significant protection if it's somebody who's been here 5 years to continue.
My comment was just because I've worked in situations like this, although the 90 days is longer than what I was thinking would. But I would think that, first of all, when somebody starts a new job, you don't just say, okay, there it is, help yourself, because usually they have to know where the things are at, and so they usually are put with somebody else for quite a while till they get used to the place and where everything's at and everything. And so there is we usually call it a probationary period when somebody first starts to work so that they do have somebody with them. Secondly, secondly, is that probably somebody's going to kind of come in, if they're going to do something like that, they're kind of going to case the joint, you might say, and they're going to wait and kind of get used to the patterns of when people are there and when they're not and when they could be alone with them, and that takes a while, I think. So maybe I'm just thinking that might help a little bit to know that those things are what would take place before something would happen, hopefully.
You've been exposed to a higher class of perpetrators than I am. Any other questions? All right. Do you have other testimony that you want to ask to hear from?
No, explain the draft and then take any other questions you might have.
Is there anyone? I have two people here that I want to hear from on 124. First, Monta Fay Lane. Are you here or online? All right. Melvin Richardson.
Chairman, this is Melvin Richardson. I represent the
Could you speak up, Melvin?
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, in reading through the last draft, I found some inconsistencies beginning on page 10, in the second line, 10 through 17, on page 10, and line 28 through 31, and then on page 11, line 1 through 10. I have no problem with what is being attempted there. However, in lines 10 through 17, the long-term care ombudsman is not responsible for all the residents of the home. For example, MHKD, 95% of the homes have no LD, probably even higher. So I believe that where it says the long-term care ombudsman will be notified, I believe it should be modified to say long-term care husband will be notified if the resident is 60 years of age or older. They have no authority over any of the other or investigative responsibility for individuals under that age.
I'm sorry.
The thing is that the entire paragraph C and the entire paragraph D, you have different, in C you have identified specific people to be given written notice, which is different than the people who are to attend the conference in D. I believe that the whichever language you, whichever people you want to be identified should also be the people that attend the conference. I just think that the language should be your language.
Okay, let me see if I got that straight. You're saying the language, page 10, lines 10 through 17 should be the same as the language, that's what, let's see, page 10, line 28 and following down through line 10 on page 11?
Yes, sir. At least the individuals notified to be or identified to be at the conference should be the ones who are identified and receiving the written notice.
Okay. And what was the other section, sir?
And the other one was in the C, which is line 10 through 17, where it said that the long-term care ombudsman would be notified in writing. It should be that the long-term ombudsman would be notified if the resident is 60 years of age or older. Which would also be similar mirror language in the subparagraph D, which is the people who are to attend the conference.
Okay. Anything else, sir?
No, sir. I have again looked at the on page 5, the line 8 through 18 about, or yes, line 8 through 18 that addresses conviction of an individual who had perpetrated committed a crime against a member of a nursing home or assisted living home, and I believe that can be addressed successfully in regulation if the language is adopted as is, by simply putting the burden of proof or a conviction on the person who wishes to employ. They would have the burden of proof of 30 days to 60 days in order to prove and bring forth appropriate documentation to show that
their conviction did not involve a person residing in a nursing home or assisted living home. So I believe that we could live with that.
I'm sorry, you can live with it as it is in the bill? Yes, sir, and it can be addressed on how to actually do it in regulation.
Okay. Anything else, Melvin?
That's all I have, sir.
Melvin, you probably heard, did you hear our earlier discussion where I was asking about what do we do with hiring a person who's just arrived in a state for whom there's no in-state records and putting them to work for the 90 days while we're waiting the FBI search?
Yes, sir, and I do understand the concern. However, it's not just for people who are just off the boat. You could have a resident who was in the state of Alaska for 10 years or less, and they have a clean Alaska record, but have committed many crimes prior to coming to Alaska. So it's not just the people that are getting off the airplane and looking for the job. It is people who are also done pregnant from the day of the last day. If you're going to put a time limit, you might want to consider something that they must have been a resident of the state of Alaska for 15 years. Or at least go back to our initial barrier of 18 years. Otherwise, you would serve no purpose by just making effective with those who got off the plane and immediately saw the plane. That's my opinion.
How practical is it, Melvin, to have the person that just got off the plane, so to speak, work under supervision and not work alone pending the national criminal record search?
With large agencies, nonprofit agencies such as HOPE, ASSET, ARCA, REACH, and some of the others, it would probably be possible, sir. However, when you get out to the smaller communities like Ketchikan, Fairbanks even, where the labor pool is a great deal less, what would happen is that they probably would not be able to recruit sufficient employees to perform the mission, which is to take care of the residents. Anchorage has no problem. Fairbanks may not. Juneau has a problem recruiting people with appropriate qualifications. It is unfortunate, but the labor pool of care providers continues to shrink while the need for services continues to grow.
All right, thank you. Just got a note that Montefe Lane is back online. Can you hear us, Montefe?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, please identify yourself for the record and who you work with and give us your testimony.
Montefe Lane, president of the Alaska Caregivers Association. I live at 109 East 5th Street, North Pole, Alaska, operator of two assisted living homes.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, is this Representative Dyson that I'm talking to?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thanks. I'd like to thank you for letting me come before you today and all the representatives of the Health Committee for allowing me to speak. On section 6-9, termination of a residential contract and emergency and voluntary termination of contract. This section is necessary for a home to be able to operate in a manner that is safe, not only to the staff, but to the other residents. Further, the home must have some latitude to operate their business. If this is taken away from the home, they become liable for the safety of others and cannot make pertinent business decisions for themselves. No home is going to arbitrarily remove a resident from their home without seeking all remedies available. And those who think otherwise are people who do not know their own business and who do not have the responsibility, both physically and fiscally, for other people. And this amendment must not be changed. I'd also like to say on the barrier crimes that you were talking about there, I just got a new revised draft of the bill. I haven't had time to read what's going on because I had the old bill before me this whole time. And we just got it faxed in to us from Juneau, so I haven't had time to go over it. But when you're talking of the barrier crimes, and as you were speaking of someone just getting off of the plane and needing a job, I do see a real burden for some of these crimes that I do not see that they're clearly defined, and they're pretty broad. I see a burden out in the village for labor pools. I see in the rural areas of Alaska, even Fairbanks, with you having this right to welfare work program, you're going to find many, many people out there in that area alone. Maybe they've had an argument with their husband or their wife, and they yah-yahed one another, and they have a domestic violence on them. But they're not really a really violent person, but that crime is there. I think these all should be looked at individually. And I think that if I was interviewing a person who just got off of the plane, and I didn't have the opportunity to have a name check, a fingerprint, FBI, and the whole bit there, I believe that I would tell them, you know, I would have them on a temporary work basis at my home under supervision until I could get a background check on them. And that's how I feel about barrier crime. section 14 of the old piece of paper, the old draft bill that I was using, and talk about court order, temporary administration, or receivership. This section is completely unacceptable. The majority of licensed homes in Alaska are small 1 to 5 bed homes that are private homes. It would be unthinkable that the state would come into a private home and take over while an owner administrator lives in that home. The state needs to strengthen the statute, the regulations, and other areas, and have follow through with those statutes and regulations rather than impose receivership on private homes. This bill addresses the possibility of owners, administrators, staff. I think I mentioned something different here. Okay, and then I'm going to go into something else. We're talking about the background checks on people again. This bill addresses the possibility of owners, administrators, staff, and volunteers who bring harm to a vulnerable adult. However, this does not address the vulnerable adult who moves into our home and brings danger and harm to others, homeowners, volunteers, and other residents of the home. And believe me, we have violent people who come into our home. We have had in the past an incident with a resident who brought a gun into a licensed assisted living home and discharged this gun multiple times within the home. We were very fortunate that no one was wounded. However, the potential was there. Many of us have experienced residents who have had unknown histories of violence and have committed assault to a staff member and or resident. This is totally unacceptable, and our association would like to see language included in this bill that would also protect those serving and living in the home. In closing, please be gentle with the requirements for employment and assisted living. Excluding the Pioneers Home, we have limited resources and a limited work pool to draw from. Also consider that when we say we, this is inclusive to the bush. You must not lose sight of the fact that the work pool is even more limited outside Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. These homes must also operate on their community resources, which are far more limited than ours. The felonies and misdemeanors must be very directly related to our industry and must give people opportunities to be gainfully employed even when they have made a mistake. We're supposed to be Christian, forgiving people, and there are people who make mistakes. And if they have had treatment and they are trying to do the right thing, we should give them a chance. And that's really all I have to say, and I thank you, and I'll see you guys in Juneau next week.
Yeah, thank you. When will you be down?
I'm coming down on Tuesday morning, and I'll be there until Thursday. Myself and the secretary of the association, Leslie Orball, which she may be in Anchorage now to speak. I don't know if she's there now. But we're coming down, and we have appointments with a lot of you guys down there and ladies, and we're going to enjoy getting to talk to you. It'll be my first time to ever visit the capital of anywhere, and I'm going to enjoy it.
All right, and I would really encourage you to bring your issues and specifics about it to the sponsor, Representative Halcrow.
I sure will.
And
I do have an appointment with him also on March the 28th, and I'm going to get to sit down in person and talk to him about it, and that's going to please me very much.
All right, this bill has a subsequent here. Referral to judiciary, so there'd be another chance to get your criticisms and suggestions incorporated.
Well, I appreciate it very much, and being an assisted living home operator who lives in a 5-bed home, you know, we've had a lot of help from the representatives and senators down in Juneau and getting an increase in the general relief pay on Senate Bill 73 last year.
All right.
And we really appreciate all that you guys do for us down there, and I'm looking forward to meeting with you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lorraine? Would you like to help us out with this?
Hi, my name is Lorraine Durr. I'm the president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. With the addition of the nursing homes into the legislation, there is some concern on part of some, our concerns on the part of our members. Since this came out last Thursday, I've not had an opportunity to convene the long-term care committee. They've been in Chicago at a long-term care, national long-term care committee meeting this week. But one of them that I did talk to is concerned with the inclusion of contractors and volunteers in the language. And the department has assured me that contractors do not include plumbers or telephone repairmen or someone like that. But sometimes when sheetrockers, well, they probably wouldn't be in the room providing services when the person's there, but the telephone men or the plumbers might be. But sometimes when regulators write regulations, they become a little bit overzealous. And the sponsor statement says these changes include limiting the access of workers. And so when there's some, you know, they can take that language and go with it. So contractors are one concern. The other concern is volunteers. And as some of the people who have testified have said, in the smaller places, there's a lack of supervisory staff. And Representative Wilson might be able even to speak to it, like in a nursing home in Wrangell, where you have people come in and feed, and it's not an occasional volunteer. People come and feed people every day. And there's not a supervisor in that dining room when people are being fed. Can that be addressed? It probably can. But our nursing home administrators are very concerned with including any kind of volunteers in here. It opens up a whole new can of worms, and you always have trouble getting volunteers anyway. And if you're going to start including fingerprints on volunteers, I mean, you know, up in some of the rural areas, I think you'll see your pool of volunteers disappear. So those are the two primary areas that they're very concerned with. I would like to have the opportunity to have the long-term care committee meet and review the nursing home language edition, which I will do soon.
When?
Hopefully next Tuesday. I don't know. They're not back yet, so yeah, I haven't set it up yet.
And Lorraine, you can see that we're trying to run a balance here. Representative Halcrow, I think very rightly, is concerned about some high-profile assaults that have been on seniors and vulnerable adults, and I think rightly is interested in doing what we can in statute to protect those folks. And concurrently is this law of unintended results, where we make things so cumbersome and so difficult that it's going to be hard to find, hire, and employ people. What should we do? Where's the balance there?
Well, and I think that's it. With the balance is excluding contractors, excluding volunteers, include your employees, include your administrators, include those kinds of people, but don't make it to the point where in your rural areas you make it so cumbersome that they can't operate. Plus the fact of the added costs that you're adding. We're talking about creating a long-term care task force to look at containing costs. This continues to add cost. So there is the balance, and exactly where that is, I don't know.
If you can't tell us, who can?
Well, I'd like to convene the committee and see what they would come up with.
When on Tuesday?
I think it's at 3.
Bad timing.
Maybe I should try to make it 10.
7.
7?
Yeah. Because it is literally the purview of this committee to look after the health issues and so on. We might be able to talk to convince ourselves that some of the legal things and the criminal justice stuff we could download to the Judiciary Committee, which is the next committee of referral.
Let me try it on Monday afternoon and see if I can get them to meet on Monday afternoon.
Okay, we'll see what this committee wants to do. There's a question?
Well, I guess I just, I myself would feel far more comfortable because the nature of this legislation is to try to protect seniors, and I think I just remember through the many years that I've read stories on abuses, it seems that sometimes it has been volunteers, and there might be a way to fix that without you know, I don't know, but there might be a way to fix that if
Sir?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification, and we'd, of course, be willing to, again, for the record, Kevin Hand, but to discuss it further at length. But just as something to point something out, it does specifically, in both sections that regard to it, it specifically prohibits a contractor, employee, or regular volunteer. And then in Section 2, it provides specific exemptions. And I believe this came out of legal drafting, that we would make it as tight and concise as possible and then only limit very specific exemptions. And those exemptions, if I could point out to you, are number 3, an individual who occasionally volunteers in a nursing facility and who is supervised by and performs these volunteer services in close physical proximity to the staff of a nursing facility. Thought that was the best way, that it was a volunteer, but yet they were supervised. And in 4, a contractor who does not provide services directly to one or more residents or have unsupervised access to a part of the facility where services are directly provided to residents. And that was an opinion, if it assuages the committee at all, a legal opinion, whether to make it as tight as possible and then to do specific exemptions, which would therefore allow these instances where contractors, volunteers, or such might have access to residents without having to go forego a background check. And that was the rationale for including them in the list of people who are not allowed, but yet then specifically exempted, if that explains anything.
Representative Cargill?
This has been my experience in working with volunteers and being a volunteer, that the paid staff usually has a direct say over who does and does not volunteer and what their responsibilities are. In the church, many times we would have people working with children as volunteers, and many of them we did background checks on because they would be in kind of a supervisory place. Now, there's all volunteer. We didn't pay anybody, but some people working under their direct purview, if it was just the occasional work, we didn't do that. We just left that as a supervisory responsibility. So even in a hospital, it's probably a little tighter than that because of medications. And is that the case, Lorraine? Do you find that your volunteers are under that kind of scrutiny, or is that something that we need to put in even tighter?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's true. They are under the scrutiny, but when you get in the rural areas where... Yeah, it's true. Probably, let's say in a nursing home where you've got 90 beds, you have a dining room supervisor, you have somebody in there all the time. When you're looking at a nursing home where there are 10 people in there and you have one person or two people on that are on staff at that point in time, they turn it over to volunteers. Now, you know, again, you're going to go back to the definition of what occasional means. I mean, there are none of our nursing home administrators who want harm to come to any of their patients. I mean, we definitely believe with, you know, the body of the bill. But when you get to drafters and you get to regulations, what does occasionally mean? And that's where the definition comes in. And I'd be glad to work with Kevin to see if there's something else that we can come up with. But the administrators are much more adept at responding to this than I am.
Okay, and I'm wondering if, although there's a smaller labor pool in the small communities, it's also everybody knows everybody. And it just seems to me that local references, you know, could be extremely valuable there, where the person who just gets off the boat, so to speak,
sure,
won't have them. And I would suggest for you that there is, you know, an out, and you need to talk with the legal people, but see if indeed you can do the Alaska background check, have references from either the permanent staff or the board, you know, as a further safety valve on the hiring for those people. And absent that, then I personally would hold out for no unsupervised contact with the clients until the long-term background check is done. My own personal conviction. I'm going to ask that we hold this over until first order of business on Tuesday to give you a chance to work on this. Are you still online, Mona?
Yes.
All right. So you're going to have a chance here to spend the next 4 days looking at the version that we have before us. I think that's the old version, the /O, and digest that and see and bring your concerns up with the sponsor. But I want to warn you that the train's about to leave the station here, and whatever needs to get reconciled in all this, you got about 4 more days. Okay?
I'm going to try to get
All right. Any other further discussion from the committee? Please understand, we're not trying to foul you up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. All right. Next order of business. House Bill 142. Listen, for all of you who are really patient here, our committee aide has given us pretzels. And I don't need more pretzels. So, Randy, would you at least pass my dish up and down the aisle?
Very good idea.
And anybody else with high blood pressure up here, they can pass theirs too. So, who's going to be making the presentation on 142? Jim? Representative Jewell has just got something from Alaska Legal Services.
Randy?
Have you got a copy of this, Jim? You want to keep this secret from the administration?
No,
right?
Absolutely not.
I'll make some copies.
Yeah, thank you.
Here's one. Mr. Norland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Nordland. I'm the director of the Division of Public Assistance, and thank you very much for scheduling this legislation. House Bill 142 makes amendments to the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, and just to remind the committee members, the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program is the program that was created under the welfare reform law that passed the legislature in 1996. Let me just ask, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to talk about the bill. Should I talk about the bill as introduced or the CS that the committee has in front of them?
Well, why don't you start with telling us where we're at and what the problem is and why we need to do something different.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about the solutions that we have before us and the committee substitute that I think you're going to say you prefer.
Okay.
Please.
The bill really addresses four separate issues related to the law. They're pretty unrelated, actually. We did take a look at the law to try to figure out what kinds of changes might need to be made to it. And I will say that a credit to both the legislature and the administration, the temporary assistance program has been very robust. This is the first time we have needed to come in front of the legislature and ask for any amendments to that program that has been so successful, really moving people off of public assistance and into employment. But the provisions that we're asking for here are rather important. There is one in which one of the provisions in the bill is in response to a lawsuit that the state lost. When I'm done here, I'd like to have Kristen Bomagen from the Department of Law come up and address that particular provision of the bill, because she is familiar with the lawsuit and with the approach that we're taking in this legislation to address that lawsuit. The other three provisions of the bill I can talk about now. The main one is deals with the 60-month limit. If the committee will remember, the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program provides cash benefits to low-income families, and under one of the main provisions of the welfare reform law, it limits those cash benefits to families to only 60 months. That is based on the five-year limit, the lifetime limit that you're all familiar with in the law. Congress and the legislature recognized that not everybody on temporary assistance is going to be able to get off the program, that there are inevitably people on the program who have significant problems and significant barriers that need to continue on the program and to continue to be able to provide those benefits for their children. It's important to remember that the ATAP program is a program that provides benefits to parents on behalf of their children so that they may be taken care of. What Congress said is that 20% of the caseload can be exempt from the five-year limit, and it left it up to the states to decide who would be eligible for those exemptions. When we passed the Timber Assistance Law in 96, we pretty much knew that that was going to be for the provision in the federal law, and we replicated that 20% requirement in our state law. The real problem here is a math problem, really what it comes down to. The 20% applies to the caseload at the time, that in the year that you look at the 20%. And neither Congress nor the legislature, I think, anticipated how much the caseload was going to come down over the course of the last 5 years. In Alaska, our caseload back in 94 was about 12,000. We anticipate that in FY03, when the five-year limit kicks in Alaska, it's going to be around 5,000. And so if you take 20% of the 12,000, that's approximately 2,400. That was probably a pretty good number in terms of if you look at the caseload and the characteristics of the people on the caseload, that's probably a pretty good number to think, absolute number of people that you'd think maybe should get extended. Well, now we have to apply that 20% to the 5,000 figure, or to the lower figure, and that is that's basically a 53% reduction in the number of people who can be eligible for an exemption. So in the original bill that the governor introduced, we asked the legislature to simply get rid of that 20% arbitrary cap, and that we thought the best approach was to, in regulation, is to allow the department to define very strict objective criteria as to who could get an exemption we're changing the language, not an exemption, but an extension beyond the 60 months. And that if the person met the hardship criteria, if they were disabled, if there were other issues, which would be obvious to many of us, would prevent them from being able to go to work, that family would therefore get an extension. It was open-ended. We knew that there was going to be probably some issues with the legislature on leaving it so open-ended. So what you see here in the CS is a different approach, that instead of leaving it an open-ended, basically getting rid of the entire cap notion entirely, the CS approach says we're going to keep it at 20%, but the 20% is going to apply to the caseload as it was in 1994 versus the caseload that it is today. Now, we use the 1994 figure because that is the figure that the federal government uses. That is sort of a base year that the federal government has used to determine our block grant, the amount of money that we get from the federal government to run this program. We're not married to the 94 figure necessarily. It's commonly used as a base year. So that is really the heart of the bill. That's what we're asking the legislature to consider here, is to recognize, first of all, that there are families on the caseload that harm is going to come to those children unless they're extended beyond 60 months. And these are families that, despite their best efforts, truly working the best they can to try to get off the caseload, they can't do it because they have significant barriers that prevent them from doing so. So that's one section of the bill. There's two other sections of the bill that are not really related to that. I don't know if you want me to entertain questions now about this.
Let me see if I can summarize what I understand. Bill was passed. It said you can't exempt more than 20% of the people for the 60-month absolute lifetime limit. The department has, they claim, been quite successful at getting people off the rolls. They're estimating that in a couple of years it'll be down to 5,000. The 20% of 12,000 and change, was 2,400 people that the department maintains is something like the hardcore unemployed that will not be in the foreseeable future employable, some of it because of disabilities, some of it because of child care and other responsibilities and so on and so forth. So they're asking for relief from the 20% figure on an annualized basis. One of the possible solutions was to put all kinds of very rigid criteria for the waiving of the 60-month limit into statute. Instead, Mr. Nordlund is proposing in the committee substitute that we maintain the 20%, but it be 20% of the original 12,000 people, not the 20% of what the number is on any given year, and is promising and committing to put all the hard-nosed regulations in place about who can receive a waiver. And the department is offering and committing to put that into regulation. Is that correct, Mr. Norton?
That's true. And there's a provision in the bill here that allows the department to draft those regulations. I might point out that to the committee that you have in your backup package here, you have, first of all, a sectional analysis on the bill. You also have a chart here that kind of very simply shows the issue of the applying 20% to a lower number is obviously a lower number, and that's really the heart of the issue. We also have in the backup projections as to when the number of people that, if we agreed, the number of people that would be, that are truly hardship cases that would, that the year in which that number would eclipse the allowed exemptions. And that's kind of a tricky exercise of doing projections. And finally, a couple pages in here that describe the kinds of problems or barriers that these families have, some case histories of families that have problems that illustrate those situations. So in response to your comment or your question, Representative Dyson, the kinds of things that we would put into regulation would be addressing the families that have these kinds of barriers. Physical health problems, disabled children in the home, disabled relative in the home, victims of domestic violence, people who have mental health issues, substance abuse issues, learning disabilities, literacy issues, and then multiple challenges, perhaps combinations of all those things.
All right. Summer, do we have people that want to testify on this bill?
Jerry Jackson.
Okay. Jim, who else do you want to have testify?
Well, I wanted to talk about two other sections of the bill and have Kristen come up and talk about the lawsuit. Right? The other, if you look at the CS, I think that's the easiest way to talk about this. The section of the bill
that's the backslash C version?
Right, C.
Okay.
What I just talked about here is in section one, the second part. Section 2 of the bill deals with a conformity with federal law issue. Under federal law, people who live in Alaska Native villages with an unemployment rate, as determined by the state, of over 50% are exempt from the 5-year limit. We don't that actually was put into the federal law after, I believe it was done after. After the first, I think it was an amendment to the federal law in later years, and so our law does not reflect that. This is an amendment that would allow Alaska's law to come in conformance with federal law, and we then would also continue to pay benefits to folks who live in Alaska, federally recognized Native villages with unemployment rates over 50%.
Okay.
And then section... Section 4 of the bill is a relatively small change to a section of the law that deals with the requirements of a family self-sufficiency plan. Basically, every family who receives temporary assistance has to have a family self-sufficiency plan developed for them that charts their course of how they're eventually going to get off of welfare. In the original law, we exempted people who have disabilities from that. And we think that it's appropriate that even though you're disabled and even though maybe you're not going to actually be able to get off of work, it's still good to have a plan that might help you get, you maybe work part-time or get partially off the caseload, or not off the caseload, but get address at least some of those issues associated with that disability. And that we would presumably work together with other agencies, DVR, whoever else might be working with that family to combine that plan and work positively for that family. So.
What section are you now describing?
I'm describing section 4 in the CS.
Which is repealed?
Yeah, it repeals the exemption for people who have a disability from having to have a family self-sufficiency.
Did you describe section 3?
I did not describe section 3, but I'd like to have Kristen Bomagin do that.
Okay. All right. Is there any questions for Jim before he disappears?
Yeah, just... Section 4, just in a nutshell, real quick again, what it's eliminating the exemption of
There's currently in the law, there's an exemption for people who have, who are on the caseload but have a disability from having to have a family self-sufficiency plan. So we don't want to exempt them anymore. We want them to have a family self-sufficiency plan.
I can get a copy of the code here for you if you want.
No, that's right.
You believe him. Ma'am.
Yes. For the record, my name is Kristen Bomingen. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Department of Law. I'm going to address Section 3 of the Draft C at Section 1 in the original version of the bill. This goes to a decision that was made by the Superior Court that invalidated a regulation of the department for administering this section of statute. Now, I was here, I worked on the original welfare reform bill, and I was representing the state in the litigation in the Jackson appeal. And so I'm speaking from that context.
Jerry Jackson?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman, the name on the case was not Jerry Jackson, but I believe Mr. Jackson was involved. Yes. It was Christina Jackson, right? When the original form of AS 4727015F was passed, it included the terms. It was intended to, when there were periods of higher employment availability in the state, to treat two-parent families differently by reducing their benefit at a time when they might be expected to be able to find employment, even though they're on the caseload. This was part of the discussions that went into the bill. And the wording that was selected when that was made was the wording that was taken to qualify two-parent families from the AFDC language. Now, that was eligibility based on the unemployment of the family's principal wage earner. With the change in welfare reform, that language disappeared from the federal statute. That language disappeared from, or that the activity of evaluating the unemployment of a family's principal wage earner disappeared from the functions of the department. Taking the discussions that had been had during welfare reform, the department generated a regulation that addressed the concerns of the legislature, as stated in committee hearing notes, minutes, and the rest, and generated a regulation that provided for the exemption of families in which there was a second needy parent who was unable to engage in physically unable to perform gainful activity. And so that is what the regulation said at this time. The Jackson family appealed that determination. The department's hearing officer said that, in fact, because of the intent of the bill, it wasn't necessary for the department to make an evaluation of the unemployment status of a wage earner. And then that was appealed to the Superior Court. The Superior Court interpreted the language that appeared in the statute and said that, no, the regulation that we had in place was not adequate, and that we had to do an analysis that was truer to the language of the law. So the proposal that we have in Section 3 is an effort to rectify the miscasting of language that occurred in the original bill, to refer internally in the Act to the qualifications for a two-parent family, which appear at AS 4727-0104. Refer to those directly, and to make a consideration for the families in which the second needy parent is unable to work.
Questions from the committee? Do you have anyone else you want to have testify, Jim? It's your planning on the department. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. So both parents in this Section 3, both parents are unemployed, and one is disabled in some way. Am I assuming that's what you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Representative Wilson, in the language as it appears now, there's no reference to unemployment status or employment status of either parent. I mean, as it's proposed here, I'm sorry. There will be no reference to the unemployment status. they may be a parent employed and they may be earning income that still they're still eligible to receive assistance under the program.
Okay, I guess
maybe I could.
Needy is maybe I'm just wondering. Lots of times, if you're already under the regulations of the department, you're physically or mentally unable to perform gainful activity. Do they draw? I don't even know SSI or ISS. What is it? Some kind of a check to help out with that?
I'll just answer the question. If they receive SSI and adult public assistance, then they would not be receiving temporary assistance, and it would not be covered by this program. But let me just say, the issue about the disability really is a bit of a red herring here. That is not really the issue. If somebody is a two-parent family and one of the family members is disabled, they do not get their benefits cut in the summer. It has to be two people in the family able to work. So it just happened, this lawsuit, one of the folks was disabled, isn't that right, Kristen? We don't apply the two.
Actually, in this case, it was a child that was disabled and not an adult.
That's right, the child was.
And so this language wouldn't address that kind of a circumstance.
Yeah.
All right. Are you done? Mm-hmm. All right. What I'm going to try and do here is hear from these. I have two folks in Anchorage that want to testify. Is that all that's offline, Summer?
There's still one.
But there's only two.
Mr. Jackson is an office, and Ms. Nelson is on today.
Okay. All right. Mr. Jackson, sounds like you've got a dog in this fight. Can you help us out here and make your comments brief if you can, but to the point?
Absolutely. In 1997, we went down south knowing that we would have problems with our child at birth. When she was born without a name, without a vagina, club foot, spina bifida, micromeningocele at the base of her spine, and associated medical conditions. My wife dealt with these issues for 2 years and 23 surgeries. And we got popped with a seasonal reduction in 98. We were left with no choices. We either had to sell our only means of making a living in rural Alaska, which was our fishing permit, to pay rent. When it came back in 99, and 2 months before graduating college, we protested this. If I had been able to take a job, I would have. If I had a, we would have lost all medical and our Alaska residency. We were between a rock and a hard place. This piece of legislation, these battles are gone for us now, but this piece of legislation will not address those people with special kids that have needs out of state. What that will do, it will be, again, putting hardship and burden on these parents. This issue was addressed by the court system, and this is only a means of trying to circumvent exiting the situation. I think it's unconscionable. What I'm hearing is mostly in-state issues. We had to fight for our residency for 3 years, and it's been an uphill battle. My wife was at the hospital more. She was at home. I attended school full time, graduated with a 3.5 GPA. It was meaningful endeavors. I had no choice. I wish I could have gone to work. I wish I could have made it easier. But to do so would have devastated my family, and we would have lost our residency. This bill has a real people effect as far as others that are facing this situation presently.
Mr. Jackson?
I'll open it for comments.
Yeah, Mr. Jackson, does this bill make it any worse for people in your situation?
I would think so. I mean, if it's the same old business as we've been doing in the past, where we don't address those individual cases, yeah, it's definitely going to hurt those families. I mean, and for young people, you know, that believe them, that don't have the capacity to hold on by. We're looking at out-of-state abortion. We're looking at kids being left at the hospital. I mean, my wife jumped around for two weeks from hospital to hospital, 48 hours after a C-section, because some bureaucrat in the Medicaid system made a mistake. It was and is unconscionable to put people through this that have a horrendous job of dealing with a special needs kid and trying to take care of business at the same time.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Jackson? Please stay online, Mr. Jackson. Nicole Nelson in Anchorage. Can you hear us, Nicole?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, please give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nicole Nelson, and I am staff attorney for Alaska Legal Services. We believe that there are two fundamental problems with State Bill 142, and that these problems will have a detrimental impact on disabled Alaskans. The first problem concerns Section 1 of House Bill 142, which proposes to amend seasonal benefit reduction.
Nicole, can you speak a little louder and a little slower, please?
Sure. Thank you. Alaska Legal Services represented the Jackson family in the lawsuit which spurred the proposed legislation. And we would like to share with you their story. Now, I know that Jerry has done that a little bit, but there are some facts of the story that you don't know that I think are relevant today. The Jacksons are a two-parent family with three children, the youngest of which was born with several birth defects and is severely disabled. Both of the Jackson parents were trying desperately to support their family and still provide proper care for their disabled child. Ms. Jackson was unable to work because her child's disabling condition demanded around-the-clock medical care and attention. These parents realized their family would never become self-sufficient unless Mr. Jackson was able to obtain a higher-paying job. So they followed the family's self-sufficiency plan designed for them by the state. This plan required Mr. Jackson to attend a full-time two-year welding program so that he could get a higher paying job and support his family. However, when Mr. Jackson was within 2 months of completing this program, his family received notice that their AHAP benefits would be cut in half for the next 3 months. Since the family was barely making ends meet without the cut, this reduction meant not only that the family could not meet its most basic needs and face homelessness, but it also jeopardized Mr. Jackson's completion of the welding program and thus moved the family further away from self-sufficiency. The Jacksons asked the state for an exemption from the seasonal benefit reduction, but were told that the state did not have the flexibility to grant such an exemption. Their tragic situation was the basis for the Superior Court's decision in Jackson versus the state of Alaska. In that case, the Superior Court held that the regulation which prevented the state from granting the Jacksons an exemption was inconsistent with the seasonal benefit reduction statute and remanded the case back to the state. With that regulation gone, the state was able to grant the Jacksons an exemption from the seasonal benefit reduction based on their compelling circumstances. Now what the proposed amendment would do is change the statute so that it mirrors the restrictive and faulty regulation, and this would take away the state's ability to exempt families with disabled children from the seasonal benefit reduction. Any legislation which would punish families like the Jacksons who are doing the right thing by both working toward self-sufficiency and taking proper care of their disabled child simply isn't just. We are asking that you oppose what is Section 1 of House Bill 142. I don't have the committee substitute, so I'm referring to the original bill, or that you carve out an exemption for parents who must provide home care for a disabled child. Now, the second problem with House Bill 142 is that it mandates that all disabled parents have a self-sufficiency plan in order to get benefits. Currently, disabled persons can and do participate in self-sufficiency planning. However, they are not required to do so in order to receive benefits. There is no evidence to suggest that there has been a problem with this system, and nothing indicates that disabled persons have been abusing it. Without such evidence, there simply is no justification for making it more difficult for people with disabilities to access public benefits.
Nicole?
Yes.
Are you where I could send you a fax?
Yes, I am.
What's the fax number that works for you?
Let me just ask. I am at the LIO in Anchorage.
All right. You've got that number, Randy?
Yeah, I'll get it.
Would you go fax her the committee substitute, please?
Okay.
All right. Continue, Nicole, please. All right, Nicole, I'm going to let the Ms. Brumagen, who is here, and Jim attempt to answer the points you've raised, and then I'm going to give you a chance to rebut their explanation. So stand by.
Thank you.
Please.
Maybe I could just go back in time here a little bit.
Jim Norland.
For the record, Jim Norland, and talk a little bit about, you know, how the two-parent benefit reduction came about. I, as well as Kristen, was here every stroke of the pen in developing that law that's on the books right now, so I have a very familiar with it. We had a discussion with the legislature at the time about benefit cuts, and generally this administration was opposed to cutting benefits under this program. What was being proposed was an across-the-board benefit cut. Basically, everybody was going to go from the benefit levels that are established in statute right now down 15%, I believe, or something like that. In exchange for that, we said if we're going to do benefit cuts, let's at least have strategic cuts. Let's take into consideration the circumstances of families and look at which ones might make more sense. So there were three benefit cuts that were applied when that law passed. One of them was to take into consideration housing expenses. Before, one family who has to pay $500 a month rent got the same benefit check as somebody who didn't have to pay $500 a month rent. So we took those housing expenses into consideration as we set the benefit level. That was one essentially benefit cut that happened. The second one was that it used to be that the second parent and two-parent family got a little bit of money in the grant. By virtue of being in that family, we got rid of that as well as, in a sense, a compromise with the legislature. And the third and final one is the one we're talking about here. We felt that...